So I first met Gary Horowitz in the fall of 1981. So he would have been in his 20s only. While I was waiting to board a flight to Italy, and I somehow had a sense that this little kid was also a theoretical physicist. We have this kind of intuitive sense. So maybe he was sitting there doing a calculation or something. So, indeed, we were both going to Erice to give a talk. And in fact, yesterday I was talking to Gabriele Veneziano, who remembered that meeting in 1981. So I was absolutely delighted that a few years later, the UCSB physics department was able to convince him to come here. As is well known, one nice thing about the high energy theory group here is that it's full of nice people. But even within this exceptionally nice group of people, Gary stands out. I've written only one paper with Gary and with Ian Lo, who's also here. So to me, he's a friend and a colleague, as he is to many people in this room. But Gary holds yet another relationship. Let me see. Oh, what's going on here? But Gary holds yet another relationship to me, as indicated in this photo. Incidentally, for those of you who do not know, the man over here is the chancellor of UCSB, and that lady is a former mayor of Santa Barbara and also a local judge, and hence her robe. Now, yesterday, several speakers praised Gary for being exceptionally careful and thorough and before he would sign his name to a paper. Now here he's actually signing a very important document, and you can see that he's reading it over very carefully, all the fine prints. And this document certifying that my marriage is legitimate. So every time I pull out my marriage certificate, I can see Gary's signature. So thank you, Gary, for agreeing to sign, and happy birthday. So our next speaker. So we have two Argentinians back to back, Luis Lerner.
Okay, so I should first thank the organizers for the invitation. I should say I was not a student of Gary, nor was a postdoc, and I haven't written a paper with him, though there is a chapter in the book that he edited that Franz Pretorius and I wrote. I promise one extra story about him. And I'll be using in this story the characteristics that have already been mentioned here with an R1, but I'll get there in a second. So first, I have to make an analogy with Gary and a local Hollywood character. That would be Leonardo DiCaprio. So I thought of a movie, and it's not this one. So don't worry, they are not going to be drawings or anything. It's more like this one. It's Inception. So I had that picture, and then I found it interesting that Rob also chose a picture that has Gary with a handgun. And my first reaction was, well, maybe we're both coming from Canada, and the image of is that people south of the border, they all carry a gun. But last night we heard from Eva that maybe there is something else. So the last Gary story is will also be a little bit of a revisionism, and so I'll be counting with the two characteristics that were mentioned yesterday. One is his sense of humor. That's going to be important because I'm going to blame him for something. Also, his patience. But the third one is he's a really real optimist. It was about the year 1999. There was a workshop in the ITP at that time of gravitational wave folks. So we're all trying to find out what would be the characteristics of gravitational waves when binary black holes collided. And there was a question and answer session, and Gary, this is the first time I ever saw this guy, raises his hand, and he says, I have a problem to suggest. What problem? Well, there is this class of black holes in higher dimensions that are unstable. And so someone asked, how many dimensions? And he said, 10. Everyone laughed, because there was no way in hell you could do 10 dimensions. We couldn't even do spherical symmetry at that time well. And then that's it. But he planted the seeds of an idea. A year later, I went to Vancouver for a postdoc, and then started chatting with local people there, in particular Matt Choptwick, Franz Pretorius, Bill Unruh, and then this project got going, and this was to try to understand the final fate of this Gregory-Laflamme instability. And this is how much we managed to do back then. The paper, the results were there by 2001 or so, but we only put it out, or came out published in 2003. And so this is just an illustration of this Gregor of this black string, this is an extra dimension that is, and this is the radial direction, and when perturbed, the black string would actually kind of deform. And more or less at around this point, where you saw significant deformation, the code invariably crashed. So since then, or from that time, Franz and I decided that we're going to try to solve this problem, and every year we'll give it a try for a few days, and every year we'll meet typically the same characters, Gary, Rob, Bob, Toby, and they will all ask us, so how is the project going? And invariably we'll say, well, it's crashing, it's not working. And every year, someone of that list would drop. The last one to drop was Gary. So there was this year in 2010 where both Franz and I just happened to go to two different conferences that Gary attended, both separated. And after these two conferences, we met together at Perimeter Institute. And Franz came and asked me, did you see Gary last week in that conference? And I said, yes. Did he ask you about the black string? And I go, no. And he said, well, I saw him two weeks earlier, and he didn't ask me either. So we just lost the last cheerleader. So we decided, well, let's do it. And so that very same day we started. We didn't go to dinner to Corinne's house, but we finished the problem essentially the next day. So I'm going to blame Gary for the delay in the project. And so just as an illustration, this is what we saw. So essentially, I mean, some of you have seen this before. Okay, from here you go to a more deformed state, which then shows up the same instability that will form this smaller sphere, and this process kept going and going till we could actually push the simulation about three or four generations, and that was it. Based on the fact that there is now our scale in the problem, and the robustness of the behavior that we see, then we could extrapolate what would happen, and then we basically argue that there is a naked singularity that forms in finite time. Okay, let me move on. So I'm gonna also blame Gary for this seed that I said. So he planted the seed, at least in Franz and I and a few others, that it would be interesting to consider gravity in higher dimensions. At that time, kind of in the year 2000, there was only one paper that had studied any dynamical gravitational setting, and that was a paper by David Garfinkel, and maybe it was also motivated by discussions with Gary. And so since then, some of us had actually been paying attention and trying to just bring in a little bit of contribution to this problem, and I would point to Gary's discussion, or that time where he raised his hand at this 99 conference at the ATP for planting this idea that maybe there is a reason to consider higher dimension if it is nothing else but just having fun. And so that also motivated or made Franz and I get some not so nice calls from the NSF saying you should stop wasting your time doing these kind of problems, but we find a way to ignore them anyways. So the motivation nowadays, and this is where that would be the part of the reason I'd be giving this talk, is to think within the context of ADS, ADS-CFT, and use it as an excuse to try to think of interesting problems on the gravitational side that maybe have something to do with CFTs or QFTs, and perhaps try to come up with input, especially on the dynamical side. So it gives us, for us on the gravitational camp, an excuse to study gravitational phenomena that should be equivalent to some analog on the CFT side and maybe understand some interesting questions. And there is a long list of people that are working on this. So here, even this list is incomplete. But I just show you a couple of examples. I also want to use a statement that Andy made last year at Perimeter, that basically said, well, the ADS CFT has been one of the wonderful things it has provided us, is to say the black holes are the new harmonic oscillators, or harmonic oscillator for the 21st century. And at the end of the talk, through my talk, I'll be trying to connect with this. So as you all know, the holography is a promise to the, is a path to the promised land. Everything works, everything is great, and then you can ask all sorts of questions. But I'm going to be thinking primarily on questions that are dynamical, which of course then involve, on the gravitational side, solving partial differential equations. And these are interesting in many setups, in particular to try to understand how long would it take, perhaps a quark gluon plasma to thermalize or be describable by hydrodynamics, quantum quenches. These are projects that came in collaboration with Alex, with Rob Myers and Alex Buchel, et cetera. But I'll be showing you some examples. So the main criteria here is, well, suppose you have a system, take it out of equilibrium perhaps, and then understand how it will relax. How it will relax will depend on many basic ingredients, but I want to just try to dwindle it down to the simplest possible questions, which is, well, how does equilibration take place? How is it, what is its time scale? And how and where energy flows? In order to equilibrate, the system would have to, especially in the context of highly coupled phenomena, it will have to involve some energy exchange. And interestingly, from our sake, from the point of view of the gravitational problem, many of these problems are essentially the same gravitationally. And so there is also a very strong kind of intuition that one can put forward, is to say, well, if we actually understand black holes or perturbed black holes, maybe we already know the answer, because we have studied perturbed black holes, and as was alluded in several of the talks, Gary has played a major role in understanding perturbed black holes by providing quasi-normal modes in a whole bunch of contexts. And so maybe that's enough. We just understand that if we kick the black hole will decay away with this quasi-normal mode behavior, and that's it. Well, that's true, provided some things do not happen, and this is what I'll try to argue. That maybe the problem is much more complicated. And sometimes I talk about this, the use and abuse of quasi-normal modes in the ADS-CFT context. So the first thing to notice, and I'll just allude this and show examples in the talk, that perturbed analysis and conclusions drawn from perturbed analysis are notoriously delicate. Sometimes the perturbative scheme that one uses might not be the most appropriate to actually extract from a low-order perturbative analysis, or an analysis that is only carried to just a few orders, to actually dig out interesting phenomena. We also know from the work by Wernick that quasi-normal modes are not even a basis in ADS, so we probably don't even have the right to try to understand things with respect to quasi-normal modes. And in many cases, the quasi-normal normal modes for interesting problems are not even known, and I'm just making a note of this paper, for instance, that found the quasi-normal modes for D equal 4 and 5 care ADS, and involves a lot of people very closely connected with Gary and myself, that somehow got its way into the paper. I'm still trying to understand how that happened. But of course, there are other arguments that maybe even put more of a pause in this on this line of thought, which is that care ADS is not even known to be stable. So even if we know the quasi-normal modes, we might not have any intuition or any right to try to use this knowledge to understand how the system will relax. And furthermore, if the system is not linearly stable, we can't even use the quasi-normal modes in a quasi-normal way, because there might be sufficiently exchange of energy that the system, when perturbed, might actually undergo a significantly nonlinear interaction before it reaches a state where, even if it were stable, quasi-normal modes will give us a good description. Worse yet, on the mathematical side, there are arguments for pure ADS being unstable, and there are specific illustrations of this. So how do we go about from here, and how do we try to answer the questions that I posed at the very beginning? One option is to just say, well, forget about trying to go perturbatively and just solve the full problem. Again, just put everything in the computer, and if you do work hard enough, you might get enough of an answer. And so the first example I'll give is this turbulence in the gravitational field. So for that, I need to explain a little bit what I mean by turbulence, because turbulence is this property of fluids that is not clearly well-defined, and not everyone would agree. Everyone, I think, would agree that turbulence, you know, a fluid has gone turbulence if it shows something that is sufficiently compelling for you to say, yes, it's going turbulent. But there are some very basic criteria that one can put forward, just motivated by the Navier-Stokes knowledge, or fluids described by Navier-Stokes equations. So one of the things that turbulence does is it breaks a symmetry, and you only recover back in a statistical sense. There is exponential growth of some modes, which, again, shows that this is a non-linearly stable problem. The global norm of a solution that has been perturbed that is undergoing turbulence describe these different stages where you first see perhaps an exponential decay followed by a power law and then again an exponential. Of course, this is in the non-driven case, so it's a decaying turbulence. You kick the system and then you see how it goes. There is an energy cascade that typically is direct to higher frequencies, except that in two dimensions there is both direct and inverse cascade. And of course, there is a famous Kolmogorov spectra that is given by five-thirds, by simple arguments, but in three dimensions, in two plus one dimensions, it could also illustrate a decay rate with the power of three. So if I'm gonna ask, well, could this happen in gravity? The first things, and in the past, this was discussed, there are strong arguments to say there shouldn't be turbulence in the gravitational field because, well, quasi-normal modes, but I just argue that quasi-normal modes cannot perhaps give the full picture. Numerical simulations have shown that there is an extra scale arising in the problem. That is, for instance, in the context of binary black hole collisions. You see these two objects coming together, you're perturbing the field by order one, and then you should see if turbulence actually happened, perhaps a cascade of energy to shorter and shorter wavelengths, and none of the simulations ever show this. Well, there is a caveat on that I'll get to in a sec as we go along. And of course, the workhorse that people have used many times is hydro has shocks and turbulence, and therefore GR has no, and because GR cannot have shocks, then it would not have turbulence. That's mixing two phenomena that has nothing to do with each other, yet it was put forward. But the ADS-CFT comes on this and says something completely different. Well, from ADS-CFT, lots of people, and I have a more complete list of reference afterwards, show that you can then derive a fluid gravity correspondence, and this correspondence work if the wavelet, typical wavelength in the problem times the temperature of the system is much larger than one, but just putting essentially what this temperature is in terms of density and the viscosity parameter, that gives you this, which of course then if I only stick the velocity in here, it tells me it's very likely that we're in the high Reynolds number regime. Also, there is the old membrane paradigm and a more refined version of the black holes that also point to there is a strong connection between hydrodynamics and the behavior of gravity. So immediately there's a list of questions, but that someone that comes with the gravity hat should at least find very interesting. Well, there could be a tension, the correspondence of or a tension in gravity in what we think may be going on. If there is actually turbulence in gravity, how do we reconcile this behavior with the quasi-normal expectation? If there is, does it have similar properties as in the hydro case? This difference of decay to higher or lower frequencies associated with the dimensionality of the system? And if so, what is the gravitational analog of the Reynolds number? Again, so what we're looking for is a phenomena that will pop up multiple scales, show us a linearized analysis is insufficient to understand. If we have turbulence, then there will be a possibility of such similarity in the space-time, therefore there will be a fractal structure, and this is one of the things that these black string problems show. There is a fractal structure in the behavior of the horizon. So gravity in its own was able to come up with such a behavior. And then there might be a whole bunch of other consequences that would be interesting from the point of view of possible observable consequences. Maybe it has something to do to act as a virtual sensor that knows the difference between four dimensions or higher, et cetera. And so I'll get to that story in a second. So first I need to step back and then just say, what is it that we're taking from the correspondence that was put forward by these people? And basically say, well, suppose you have a black brain and you're gonna perturb the black brain and this perturbation will come encoded in this fields, the boost that the black brain might have, and the temperature as depending on the coordinate, the extra coordinates, space-time, you put that back in the Einstein equations and assume a gradient expansion, and lo and behold, you end up recovering hydrodynamics. Of course, then if there is this clear correspondence, and we know that in the right regime, this one will give rise to turbulence, then why wouldn't it happen in the gravitational field? One could say, well, we know a lot about turbulence in the Navier-Stokes case. These equations are not the Navier-Stokes, and they're given by a very particular equation of state, which is this conformal equation of state. That might be some arguments, but it still wouldn't be compelling enough to say, well, I don't think turbulence will happen. But more importantly, one would say, well, we remember in the Navier-Stokes case, there was an indirect cascade, an inverse cascade, sorry, in the 2 plus 1 dimensions. Does that happen? Does that have a counterpart on the gravitational side? It was very important for this inverse cascade that there existed another conserved quantity called the entropy. And then the question is, does it exist for this type of systems and equation of state? And then we proved that that was the case in this paper in 2012. But we also did the simulations, and this is what you see. So I'll just show you a clip of that. So this is an initial flow, and then we are showing the vorticity. As you perturb it, obviously, the system went turbulent. You can extract all the properties that you want here and then check every single item that I had in a few transparencies ago. And importantly, you actually see this cascade to inversely. So it wants to go and develop longer and longer wavelengths. Furthermore, simulations in, this is a simulation in 2 plus 1 hydro, but simulations in 3 plus 1 hydrodynamics show the exact opposite. Turbulence that happened, but you go to smaller and more smaller wavelengths. So using the correspondence, you can build up the full spacetime in the bulk of ADS, and what you find is that the bulk of ADS is going turbulently, and what you end up describing is this kind of vortices that you could read off from the boundary are basically extending all the way to the interior and creating these gravitational wave tornadoes, if you want. Better yet, if you don't want to believe the correspondence, you can just go and write a 3 plus 1 gravity code, and this is what Paul Chesler, together with Adams and Liu did, and then just run the same initial data that we run, and then obtain the behavior everywhere, but in particular read at the boundary, and this is what they get. Of course, there shouldn't be an exact correspondence, because even though the initial data is the same, the seeds of the perturbations are different, but qualitatively, you see that there is perfect agreement. So now we know the gravitational field in the right regime can go turbulent. So let's make some observations. So the first is that the inverse cascade carries over to the relativistic hydro, and so gravitational turbulence in 3 plus 1 and 4 plus 1 move energy in very different directions. And therefore, consequently, if one is asking how long would it, a particular scenario take to thermalize, to equilibrate, will depend intimately on the dimensionality of the spacetime. I mean, this is something that was already kind of conjectured or speculated by Mark van Rastok in a talk, I think, in Israel, one of these Werner Israel Fest. And so I have two notes here. One is the GR hydro correspondence has been established in the regime where the so-called slow quasi-neural modes dominate. And this is interesting because the different communities call these things in a different way. The gravitational community for us is everything is a quasi-neural mode, so there are some that decay faster. And in the holography community, they talk about the quasi-neural modes and the hydro modes. So I just want to make sure that when I talk about what you know or some of you know as hydro modes, I'm going to call slow quasi-neural modes. And the second note is we have to be careful. There is always a limit to numerical solutions. Every time you write a numerical problem, you end up having one solution for a particular resolution. And so one has to be very careful in extracting general properties out of it. So it would be ideal to try to use the simulations or the experiment, as Subir was saying the other day, to motivate a deeper analytical analysis that would then pick up the right behavior. Of course, from the hydro and geometry point of view, there are very many interesting questions to go after. And so this has come under the umbrella of this buzzword, geometrization of hydro. But some questions are be interesting, or I think one can answer, by just shining a gravitational light into the hydro problem, is what mediates vortices merging or splitting versus splitting in two versus three spatial dimensions. Can we interpret now from a purely bona fide gravitational study, how does turbulence arise? Because everything we've been doing so far is use hydro correspondence to find something on the gravitational side. I want to see it purely arising from gravity calculation. Can we predict global solutions behavior based on geometrical considerations. It's an interesting provocative paper by Yarrow Moss and Rabinovich in 2011. And can we identify what triggers this phenomena outside the long wavelength regime that was assumed, outside the regime that is dominated by the slow quasi-normal modes? And finally, and this is the thing I'm going to show next, is whether ADS is really needed. ADS was really convenient in setting the gravitational field in a box. The only place where we could lose energy was into the black hole. But is this really needed? From a gravitational point or from a PDE point of view, ADS is only adding a lower order term in the equations. Why would that play such a significant role? So first, I'm going to step back, go to the hydro, and then ask, how do we understand turbulence in the hydrodynamical side? So one option is just take Navier-Stokes equations, assume that we write any velocity field, and for simplicity, considering compressibility, in terms of some coefficients that depends in the wave number and time, multiplied by some unit vector that basically will label the sound and shear modes. Stick that back into the Navier-Stokes equation, and then you end up with the behavior of the perturbations governed by an equation that goes like this. But the important thing I want to draw here is that there is some coefficient here that I'm going to call it collectively kappa, that depends on the three modes that are being kind of talking to each other and coupled, and the coefficients, the amplitude of the different modes. If you analyze, I mean, we can go both ways. We can say, well, conservation of energy, if you assume that I turn off viscosity in the problem, conservation of energy implies a relationship with the coupling coefficients that satisfy this. Vice versa, if the coupling coefficients satisfy this, I can derive that energy is conserved. Moreover, if the coupling coefficients satisfy this relation, so it's exactly the same one as this one, except that now the wave number magnitudes actually play a role into the square power, this is the same thing as the conservation of entropy. So either you derive conservation of entropy, which is very easy in the Navier-Stokes case, and imply that, or by analyzing these coefficients, then you can imply the conservation of entropy. And these two constraints, if you want, tell you precisely that energy cascades in one way and entropy to longer wavelengths, while entropy cascades to shorter wavelengths. So how do we try to do the same thing in the gravitational sector? So we need to go to next beyond the linear order, obviously. Linear order, the only thing we have is the quasi-normal modes. So this is what we did. So take the black hole and perturb it. Now describe the space-time as a black hole that is now has a slow time variation due to the quasi-normal mode that you used to kick it with. And now think there is a second mode that you're interested in solving for its behavior. And what you find out is that you have an equation that looks like so. The important thing is just to think of the right regime where we might see something interesting. Again, if we want to answer where ADS was needed or was just convenient, we can ask, what was ADS doing especially for us? And one of the things it was doing is make the decay rate of quasi-normal modes be slower than if you didn't have the gravity in a box. That's interesting from the PDE point of view, because that would say that nonlinearities might have enough time to do something interesting. And that's what we look for. Conveniently, I mean, Andy showed up that very highly spinning black holes can do all sort of interesting mathematical tricks. They have an R1 up their sleeves, which is there is a family of quasi-normal modes, then the limit of extremality don't decay anymore. So I'm going to concentrate on those ones, because those will last so long that any nonlinear behavior that can be triggered will be triggered. You put that in the equation using this kind of philosophy, and then you end up with an equation that looks like this. So it's a standard box operator on your Kerr background, plus some other operator now depends on time. And because of that, which is given by the first mode that I put in, and once you understand this equation, what you immediately realize is there is this parametric instability that will preferentially move energy from one mode to some other modes. And these modes have precisely the property you were looking for. They will be preferentially be getting energy into the longer wavelengths. And more importantly, you can then use the criteria of when this instability will turn on to define a gravitational Reynolds number. And it just comes out this way. So it's the amplitude of the perturbation, the background perturbation, the one we put first, the azimuthal number, and the decay rate of the corresponding quasi-normal modes. And of course, the moment you turn, you can use this expression, which just came out of this equation, and then translate into the hydro analog. So the amplitude of the perturbation is the same thing as the velocity of the background flow. The azimuthal number is the same as 1 over the wavelength. And the decay rate is nothing but the density divided by the viscosity parameter. So you get back from this equation precisely the Reynolds number. So that was the message there. The message is that in the right regime, going beyond the linear behavior, you actually are able to uncover a whole bunch of things, in particular this Charmant behavior, and understand it now from a purely gravitational point of view. How am I doing with time? So now I'm going to take a second track, a second problem, which I thought was very interesting, and I think is still very interesting in the fact that we still are not converging in some regimes, which is, suppose you now you're not in the situation that we were before, where you had a thermal state, you perturb it, and then you ask the question, when would it thermalize? Suppose you start with a case that doesn't have a thermal counterpart to begin with. So you just have in the CFT some amount of energy to throw in, and then you ask the question, how long will it take to actually thermalize? Of course, from the gravitational point of view, we have a situation where we don't start with a black hole. We're just starting with ADS, perturb, pure ADS, perturb, and then you ask the question, or we ask the question, what's going to happen? This problem, interestingly, hadn't been done till actually Bisson and Rosorowski first in the spherically symmetric case on the Santa Barbara gang at that time did it for a gravitational case. And basically especially I'm going to concentrate mainly on this problem, they just did the Chopwick problem. And if you don't know what the Chopwick problem, this is basically the following. So they said, Chopwick did it in 1986, but the paper came out in 93. He was considering a scatter field collapse. Just put some amount of energy in spherical symmetry and let it go. If you let it go, two things can happen. If it is sufficiently energetic, that comes in a sufficiently small region of the space-time, a black hole will form. If not, it will just disperse away, and that's it. But now if you do the same thing in ADS, now you're forcing that energy to bounce off and comes back in. And these guys did that, and of course, this is what they said. So this is a behavior of where you find horizon with respect to the strength of the initial perturbation. So if your perturbation is very large, you form a black hole right away. If not, then you do the same experiment again by lowering the amplitude of the perturbation, and then the black hole size is smaller and smaller. At some point, you disperse away, nothing happens, but then if you wait a little bit, then you form a black hole. So what the hell happened? This thing bounced off the origin, went to the boundary, bounced back from the boundary, and formed a black hole. And then the more they kept lowering this threshold, the more they bounced, they have to wait, but eventually a black hole always formed. So I found that so amazing that I had to go and talk to my holographer friends. And I said, sure, look at this. Isn't this very cool? And of course, as Rob said yesterday, a holographer will always tell you, of course, this was always known in holography. At which point you go, how come? Oh, obviously, on the CFT side, you have put some amount of energy, it will thermalize. Forming a black hole is the right way or a convenient way to go into a thermal state. Voila. And at that point, as he described, you just back very slowly out of the office, making eye contact. And then you go and try to lick your wounds, thinking how dumb I am. But you have this fighter in you, and then you say, well, maybe the option is much more, or the behavior is much more complicated. So actually, we press on. I mean, full thrust in, and that's what we did. So let's take again the same problem. And then we notice that if you just change ever so slightly the initial configuration, you change nothing about the problem, you just change the initial configuration. All of a sudden, you have a different behavior. And this is here. So this is a plot that shows the amount of time you had to wait for a black hole to form. For the configurations that Bisson and Rosorowski were using, as you decrease the amplitude, then you essentially had that behavior. So you just have to wait longer and longer, but eventually a black hole formed. Now you change it slightly, the width of the initial pulse, and all of a sudden, this thing happened. So the system, at some point, realized that below some energy, it just didn't want to go in the same path. We're not saying, because I stress again, that maybe this system will take a very long time, then turn around and form a black hole, but definitely something changed here. It did not want to go in the same path towards forming a black hole. How does it avoid collapse? From a gravitational point of view, we had this beautiful answer also in a workshop some time ago at the KITP. I remember having this discussion with Gary, Oscar, and Franz, and the four of us were thinking, we have to find a simple way of understanding this, and we had this perfect answer. Well, the gravitational, the scatter field is collapsing. As it's collapsing, it sees itself's gravity, it pushes itself to a slightly higher frequency, and this process accumulates, and eventually, voila, that's done. But then what happened here? The same argument could be used there, and yet it was not going that way. So there are different ways of understanding the problem. One of them is try to then just use perturbation theory. After all, if something is, if something is avoiding the collapse, we can go very close to here. This is a very small perturbation. We should be able to use perturbation to our advantage. And perturbation, the standard perturbation analysis was done, and interesting outcomes were obtained. But you can go a step further and actually say, well, let's assume that we recognize at the linear level there is a set of normal modes. Put the normal modes as a basis. Have the normal modes described by some coefficient times the normal modes. But now make these coefficients depend on a second time. It's a slow time. Why do we know that? Because if we plot any particular variable, this is the energy measure at the origin, forget about this nice, think of this solid line. You saw the system kind of increasing the measure energy at the origin and then turning around and then going up again and then turning around. And then you ask, how do I understand this? Who ordered this essentially 200 crossing times before the system essentially went around and showed a similar behavior? And then maybe at later time it collapsed to a black hole. But how do we understand this? So there is this idea that there is a second time, you put that into your equations, go all the way to third order, and voila, you end up finding an equation that looks like so, that shows that there is a coupling between the coefficients, and this goes to third order, similar to the case we saw in the Navier-Stokes case. We now have an extra coupling because we're going, the energy content is through a scalar field, so it's quadratic in the amplitude. Interestingly, if you now analyze the behavior of these equations, you identify very quickly that there are two conserved quantities that you didn't know. I mean, they are there at this order at least. One is the energy, and the other one is at something we call particle number. But again, if these two things have to be conserved, there is cascade in both directions, very much like the case with vorticity. Except that here, before we have k, amplitudes. And the amplitudes with the frequency square. Now we have frequency square, amplitude square, frequency, amplitude square. So this is not uniquely telling you one is going to go in that one direction, the other one will go in the opposite direction. Here, this is if energy is cascading to higher frequencies, this one will cascade to lower frequencies. And this process might go for a while till either you get a stable situation or this a behavior builds up and then begins to blow up. And more interestingly, these equations of motion are exactly the same as the Fermi-Pasta-Ulam single loop problem. Yeah, I'm close to finishing. So I'm not going to go describe much of these, but I'm just going to tell you that at the current moment, we're doing even going a step further using the flow K analysis to understand, see how much else we can understand from the system. And in particular, one of the things you can get very quickly is this recurrence time. This is, can be extracted from the analysis. You can also analyze the stability of some particular solutions, and how large is the stability domain of these islands, and this is all work in progress with Stephen Green and Antoine Mylar, a student at Perimeter. So I'll take the last day back to try to put everything together. And I'm going to say, well, we have some scenarios, like ADS, where we had normal modes. We have some other scenarios, like this out of equilibrium from an initial thermal state behavior, where we have quasi-normal modes, which are not a basis, but I'm going to just push in the regime of applicability a different way of treating the system perturbatively. So we're going to say, rather than saying that your metric is given by the background plus H1, H2, H3, et cetera, as typically where you end up solving a set of linearized equations, we want to solve a single nonlinear equation for that is good to second order for this perturbation H. The perturbation H, I'm going to write in terms of either the normal modes of the quasi-normal modes, and I'm going to assume that the coefficients are also kind of governed by this slow time behavior. You put that back in the equations, and then you again get something that looks like this. So it's the time derivative of these coefficients are given by some coupling coefficients time the initial amplitude of these modes. And in particular, we can very readily recognize some terms. So for instance, there are some conditions that this K and L and J have to satisfy. But in particular, one of the terms that is in here is one that you have, again, AJ. And all this thing looks like a coefficient that depends on time. This is nothing but, again, the parametric instability that we recognized before. Also, this is applicable for long wavelength in particular. And from here, we can actually compute what are these coupling coefficients. And they're exactly the same as the one you obtain in the hydrodynamic description. And so I'm finishing. This is my final comment. Well, from one side, these holographic studies have pushed us into understanding or some interesting questions. And we have eventually landed in this way of re-understanding the problem as a system of nonlinear, highly coupled oscillators. And the role of understanding the dynamics of the system is understanding these coupling coefficients. And so the harmonic oscillators refuse to be left in the 20th century, and they might have still a role to play in the new era. Thank you. Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, so suppose you, instead of just kicking the black hole and letting it evolve, you sort of try to drive it. How much do you think the horizon would be able to ripple, and do you think there would be a sort of resonance effect going on then?
Well, it will depend on how fast you're driving. So if you drive it very fast, you're in the quenching regime. If you're driving very low, you're in the adiabatic regime, so you can drive it. And if you're in the very slowly driving regime, the black hole will just accommodate with it. It will never respond with the quasi-normal modes. It will respond with a time scale governed by your quasi-normal, by your driving force. Yeah, I don't know what would happen. I can speculate, but no, I haven't thought of this.
I guess a Schwarzschild black hole should somehow be dual to just the fluid at rest.
Yes.
Do you understand any precise sense in which a rotating black hole, would that be dual to some kind of shear free flow on a squash sphere? Or can you say anything?
I think Veronica, Mukund, and Shiraz, right? So they wrote this paper precisely. So it's just a fluid that is rotating on the surface of a sphere. Of course, there is zero vorticity at the poles, and then you have this net. But because you have a net vorticity, when you actually perturb the system, you see the same thing. You see all these vortices going around. And more interesting, because there is a net vorticity, then because in two dimensions, I'm talking the two-dimensional case, vortices have to join. Then some vortices preferentially go to the North Pole, some others go preferentially to the South Pole, and you end just with two.
Any more questions?
So the black string stuff that you presented at the beginning of the talk is a naked singularity and a violation of cosmic censorship. Are there, you know, sort of other places we should look for other violations of cosmic censorship numerically? And is there any hint from the dimension dependence of turbulence as to, you know, why we would get cosmic censorship violations in five dimensions but not in four?
Right. So these are, at least in my mind, there are two different questions. So I have two different answers, and of course they should have a common denominator. But I haven't thought of that, or haven't found a way to connect that yet. So as far as the dimensionality and dependence, and where that has anything to do with the cosmic censorship. So what we do know is, if I think of the hydrodynamic behavior, right? In the hydrodynamic behavior, I can have vortices in two plus one dimensions that join and they merge larger ones, while in three plus one dimensions, they break. So if I use my gravitational intuition, so I bring that to the gravitational side, what I would be having is something that is rotating in four plus one dimensions. But that cannot be a stable rotation because there are no circular orbits there. So it would want to then collapse on its own. So somehow the system just actually wants to break it apart. Otherwise, you're going to end up with a singularity. So it's very interesting that this happened, but I don't have a good intuition about that. As far as then trying to find other places where naked singularities may arise, so Rob and Roberto and also Gary and collaborators have pointed out many systems, and others as well, that you can map onto the black string that should have a similar behavior. And Shibata and collaborators have also found another instability. So there are these obvious places where the system might behave exactly as the Gregor Laflamme, but I don't know of other options.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, right. That's one of them. Well, I mean, as far as how generic they are, well, there are many, many black holes. Like, you can map to, again, to this Gregor Laflamme instability. Well, here, as long as one of particular, in this particular case, you only need a lower bound of the length of the extra dimension. From there on, it will always happen. So it's not a fine-tuned configuration from that point of view.